Vishnupad Paramahamsa Parvraja Gachara Satara Sita Shri Shimdas Divine Grace A.C. Bhakti Vedanta Swami Maharaj Srila Prabhupada Kijai ISKCON Founder Charya Srila Prabhupada Kijai Samaveda Bhakti Vrinda Kijai Gaur Premananda. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Sri Garanga. Namo Vishnupadaya Krishna Sri Srimati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityananda. Namaste, Saraswati Devam, Gauravani Bhatrani, Nirvishesha, Srinivani, Vaskata, Visidhani. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Is this loud enough? Okay. So we're reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 9, Answers by Citing the Lord's Version. We're going to be doing chapters 26 and 27. Both very nice verses, but since 27 has the purport, I'll just read 26 and we'll do 27 responsively. Tatapi natamannasya natanataya nahitam paravare yatarupe janiyam te virupina. In spite of that, my Lord, I am praying to you to kindly fulfill my desire. May I please be informed how, in spite of your transcendental form, you assume the mundane form, although you have no such form at all. So text 27. Yatatma maya yogena. Mana shakti apabrim hitam. Vilampan Vishrajan Grinan Vibrad Atmanam Atmana Yatatma Maya Yogena Nana Shatyapa Brimhitam Vilampan Vishrajan Grinan Vibrat Atmanam Atmana Yatatma Maya Yogena Nana Shaktyapa Brimhitam Vilumpan Vishrajan Grinan Vibrat Atmanam Atmana Yata.
As much as.
Atma.
Own.
Maya.
Potency.
Yogena.
By combination.
Nana.
Various.
Shakti.
Energy.
Upabrimhitam. By combination and permutation.
Vilumpan.
In the matter of annihilation.
Vishrajan.
In the matter of generation.
Grinan.
In the matter of acceptance.
Bibrat.
In the matter of maintenance.
Atmanam.
Own self.
Atmana.
By the self. Translation purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. And please inform me how you, by your own self, manifest different energies for annihilation, generation, acceptance, and maintenance by combination and permutation. Purport. The whole manifestation is the Lord Himself. By diffusion of his different energies only, namely the internal, external, and marginal. Just as the sunlight is the manifestation of the energy of the sun planet. Such energy is simultaneously one with and different from the Lord, just as the sunshine is simultaneously one with and different from the sun planet. The energies are acting by combination and permutation by the indication of the Lord, and the acting agents, like Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva, are also different incarnations of the Lord. In other words, there is nothing but the Lord, and still the Lord is different from all such manifestive activities. How it is so will be explained later on. Om Jnana Tvandasya Gnanjana Salakaya Chaksamimitanyena Tasma Shiva Venaha Panchakalpatribhyascha Kripasindhubhyebhyascha Patitano Pavanebhyo Vaishnavibhyo Namo Namaha. So, we are in the last few verses preceding, leading up to the Chatur Shlokis. In yesterday's verse 25, Brahma states that Krishna knows all the desires of living entities. He is indwelling, and therefore he is knowing everything. Now in verse 26, he's saying, in spite of that, so that's what in spite of that refers to, in spite of the fact that you already know all my desires, I still have a desire that I want to express. And that is that I have some questions that you may kindly answer for me. So now, beginning in verse 27, in the next couple of verses, Brahma begins to ask his questions. Then Krishna will summarize those questions and the topics that he's going to discuss in verse 31, I think 32, he gives him some encouragement that you are very capable and qualified to hear this. And then 33 through 36, of course, are the famous Chatur Shlokis, the four central verses that Brahma first heard became the basis of Srimad Bhagavatam, which of course is described how through disciplic succession it was expanded and of course compiled by Srila Vyasadeva. Then of course spoken by his son Shukadeva Goswami, Maharaj Prakrit, and that is what we have today. So this is a very, very important chapter and very important verses. So the questions that Lord Brahma seems to be asking, he could ask any kind of question. I mean, think of, you know, he has Lord Krishna in front of him. He could ask anything that he possibly wanted to know. Of course, he's already seen the full spiritual world, you know, but his questions tend to be on the relationship between Krishna's pure spiritual form and the material energy. And that's generally where he's going with this. He's saying, how does the spiritual material energies, how do they act and how do they interact? Now, why would he choose these questions? I was thinking about this. Well, this is essential for Lord Brahma. He's been told, he's been entrusted by Krishna to create the material world. Take all of my material elements, and you assemble them, you put them together. You have to create all of these bodies, all of these material forms, you know, throughout the entire universe. So that's quite a job. And so he's sort of praying for the ability to be able to do that, to have the understanding, to have the knowledge. So he's very curious for himself and, of course, for the rest of us, for the Srimad Bhagavatam to be passed down through history, to know, how does this happen? How does this work between You have your material energy, you have your spiritual energy. What is the interplay? What is interaction? And of course, Prabhupada is addressing this in the purport. So Brahma is addressing the form of the Lord that he's seen in front of him. And to begin at the beginning, I guess we could say, Krishna has his original sarup, his form. And integral to that form, he originally, or I guess you could say basically, he has an original spiritual energy, which is called usually the sarup shakti or the chit shakti. So this is inherent, intrinsic within Krishna. Krishna's energies are non-different. They're there eternally. His form is intrinsic, eternal, original to him. It is not that he assumes a form as Krishna. Krishna is his form. His form is Krishna. Okay. So the sarup shakti or chit shakti is described in Adi 2.101. It says, the chit shakti, also called sarup shakti or antaranga shakti, displays many varied manifestations. It sustains the kingdom of God and its paraphernalia. So everything in existence manifests from this sarup shakti. And there are unlimited energies that emanate from the energetic source. One important verse is Parashya Shaktir Vividai Vishriyate Sabhaviki Jana Bala Kriya Cha. From the Sutashvatara Upanishad 6.8, the Supreme Lord has multipotencies, which act so perfectly that all consciousness, strength, and activity are being directed solely by his will. So we see this many, many places throughout the scriptures, many places throughout the Bhagavatam and other scriptures, how Krishna is the original. Krishna is behind everything, and he manifests different energies. So in today's purport, Srila Prabhupada mentions the three primary energies of his internal, external, and marginal potencies. And of course, these are most important. Described a little more in Adi 296, the primary potencies of the absolute truth are mentioned to be three, internal, external, and marginal. By the acts of his internal potency, the personality of Godhead in his original form exhibits the spiritual cosmic manifestation known as the Vaikuntha Lokas, which exist eternally even after the destruction of the material cosmic manifestation. By his marginal potency, the Lord expands himself as living beings who are part of him, just as the sun distributes his rays in all directions. By his external potency, the Lord manifests the material creation, just as the sun, with its rays, creates fog. The material creation is but a perverse reflection of the eternal Vaikuntha nature. So there's a nice analogy that's given by Srila Prabhupada of the sunshine, and the fog. So obviously the sun is compared to the original form Krishna, Bhagavan, and his energy is that of sunshine. So in other words, he says the marginal energies of the Lord expands himself as the sun distributes its rays in all directions. So you can see the marginal energy, the jivas, the atmas, they're coming from Krishna. We are all coming from Krishna. Just as there is sunshine, there's sunlight coming out from the sun. Now, also what happens is the sun with its rays also creates fog. How does that happen? It evaporates water, right, from oceans, lakes, rivers, whatever the sources are, or even just from the air, as we have here often. It's so foggy in the morning, just the moisture in the air. And then when the sun comes up, it actually creates the fog, but then it also evaporates the fog. So it has both powers. Anyway, the external energy is Prakriti, the Maya Shakti, matter. And that's been discussed quite a bit in the last few chapters of the second canto, as we saw all the different manifestations and the Purusha avatars and how Krishna was acting and how all the material energies were acting. Now here, Prabhupada is discussing that how Krishna manifests this material world. He says his deputed agents are Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiva. They're in charge of the process of creation, maintenance, and destruction. So that's one answer. How Krishna does this, how he manages this. He does not do it personally. It's stated that Krishna personally, as himself in his pure spiritual form, does not touch matter. But Lord Brahma, Lord Shiva, and even his Purusha avatars to some degree, although they even have some aloofness because they're never really touching or contaminated, they're always in control of material energy. But Krishna himself does not. He deputes it to his agencies of Shiva, Brahma, and Lord Vishnu. and the different Purusha, the three Vishnu avatars. So Brahma, again, is asking about his relationship with the material world. And our Vaishnava understanding, of course, that nothing in creation is different from Krishna. And that which is created, this material world, is also part of the Supreme. Now, this is, I guess you could call it jnana or bhakti jnana, you know, intellectual understanding of the nature of things. In Western philosophy, it's called ontology, which means basically the philosophical study of existence. What is a being, a reality? What is the reality? You know, how did it all, how does it all work? What does it mean? What is the meaning? What is the meaning of life in a sense? But it's really more like, what is the nature of it? What? How would we describe that? Now, in our Vedic tradition, there's two different ways of understanding this that are called Paranambada and Vivartavada. And both of these theories are actually explained quite in depth in Adi Lila 7, verses 121, and then beginning on Madhya Lila 6, 170 onwards. So Lord Chaitanya discusses these ideas, and I think this, I didn't write it down, but I think it's Adi 7, 121, the verses, Paranamavari Ishvara Hayena Vikari Etakari Vivartavada Stapani Yakari. And that is, according to Shankaracharya, by accepting the theory of transformation of the energy of the Lord, one creates an illusion by indirectly accepting that the absolute truth is transformed. Now, this is, of course, Mayavadi philosophy, and then it's gone on to, it, and it's refuted. But this is the idea. This Vivartavada of Shankaracharya is a theory of illusion. Everything is essentially Brahman. Anything that you perceive differently is Maya, is illusion. Everything is Brahman. You see material energy, you see some forms, you see yourself, you see these things all different, that's illusion, that's Maya. Now, if there's one undifferentiated Brahman, where did illusion come from? Why does Brahman put himself under illusion? How does he get out of illusion? These things are, they bewilder the mind for a Vaishnava because they don't make sense. You know, it's basically a philosophy that if you really, the more you study it, the more confusing it becomes, I find, you know. And believe me, I tried. I remember before I was a devotee, I read all of the teachings of Vivekananda. I even went through 900 pages of the teachings of Ramakrishna. Isn't it amazing how great Prabhupada's mercy is that I'm here, that I made it through complete Mayavadi contamination? But you know, it didn't really make sense. It's kind of like, I thought this is what it was supposed to be or what you're supposed to read, but it really didn't make sense. It wasn't satisfying. Anyway, I won't divert too much here, but by Prabhupada's mercy, I got his Bhagavad Gita, and it made sense. It all came together by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada. So, Prabhupada. So anyway, this is the theory of illusion, Maya, and in contrast, the Vaishnava theory is Paramanama, it's called Parinamavada, the theory of transformation. Theory of transformation. That God creates the world through his energies, through his potencies. He is not transformed, but he remains one, but his energy is transformed. In other words, all these combination and permutation, as Prabhupada translates this word, upagrimitam, which has a lot of different translations. I was looking at that through one of the beta searches. But permutation and transformation, what is it again? What was the other word? Permutation, combination and permutation, right? Permutation means basically changing, right? Things change, they permutate. What's the word? Permutate? Is that a word? Must be. Okay, so through these changes, it happens, but it isn't that Krishna changes. His energies are changing. The material combinations are coming together differently in different ways. So, of course, the Vaishnava understanding is generally called the Chinta Beda Beda Tattva, simultaneously inconceivable oneness and difference. That God is inconceivably one with everything, he is one with his creation, he is one with the living entities, and yet he remains separate, unchanged as the Supreme. Nice discussion about this in Prabhupada makes in his purport of 5.12.8, and this is Jada Bharat speaking, I think. This cosmic manifestation is a mixture of matter and spirit, but the cause is the Supreme Brahman, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Actually, he is not different, But this material world is simply a transformation of his different energies. The Supreme Lord has multiple potencies which act so perfectly that all consciousness, strength, and activity are being directed solely by his will. As we quoted from before from Sutashvatara. Lord Sri Krishna confirms the statement in Bhagavad Gita 7.4, Me Bina Prakriti Ashtada. What does Bina mean? Bina. I'm just seeing if you still are following for all week.
Without.
What does it mean?
Without.
Oh, separated, right? I think it's separate energies. In other words, these are all the Prakriti Ashtada, eight energies are separate from him. In other words, they're not the same as him. There is a distinction there. He doesn't directly touch the material energy, although it is, Prabhupada says, the material energy is Krishna's energy, but it is separated from him. The spiritual energy is also his energy, I just read that, simply understanding the transformations of different energy is partial knowledge. We must come to the ultimate cause. There's nothing in the phenomenal world that is not produced by the supreme energy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, all these manifestations are transformations of matter, permutations, combinations of matter. So the material energy is considered both real and not real. It's real in that it's Krishna's energy and it does exist, although it is sometimes manifest and sometimes unmanifest. So in that way, it's unreal because it is temporary. And there's another way that is not real. And that is because our attachments to the temporary forms is illusion. That's another way that we can think of material energy being illusory. Not just that it's temporary and it's not the highest, but also it tends to cover the living entities and that we think that these are all in all, or we think this is our real nature, and that is illusion. So, Vishnu Chakravarti Thakura said in one purport, this world cannot be eternal since it was previously not existing and it will be destroyed in the future. That's its temporary nature. It is shown to be real, by comparing it to clay and gold, which transform into pots and golden earrings. So these examples of clay and a pot. The pot is a manifestation of clay, the earrings a manifestation of gold. And I understand, but the pot can be broken and it returns to the clay. So it was real, but it was temporary. And while temporary, the material energy has a purpose. It's not just that we want to step away, the material energy is illusory, it's, no. Because the devotee considers that everything can be used in Krishna's service. And if the material world has a purpose, a valuable purpose, as long as it's used to please Krishna and to serve Krishna. So we don't consider it false, although we understand its limitations. Krishna simultaneously creates and enters the material world, yet remains separate and aloof. This is the Achinta Bheda Bheda Tattva philosophy. Prabhupada gives examples of the sun and the sunlight. The sun is the energetic source. The sunlight is the energy that depends on the source, but also it allows us to see the sun, that same energy. It's another topic, but sometimes we all can see that there's two aspects of Maya, Yoga Maya and Mahamaya. And of course, the Mahamaya is the covering potency, but Yoga Maya allows us to see Krishna. Yoga Maya is one of its functions, is uncovering. So that allows us to see Krishna. Now, we should also point out there's always this word achinta, achinta veda veda tattva. We kind of slip over the achinta very quickly, so at least I do, but achinta is important because achinta means what? Inconceivable. All right. Can we understand this all with the limitations of our material mind and intelligence? Not so easily, right? That's why Krishna says it is inconceivable, because it can be understood, but not by the material mind. And even by the spiritual intelligence, we could say, or the spiritual body of the jiva, we can never understand Krishna in full. So in that sense, it is inconceivable. To understand everything about Krishna is inconceivable, but we certainly cannot understand anything about Krishna with the material mind and intelligence. Actually, it's described that I was reading Bhagavad Sandarbha by Jiva Goswami, that through the intelligence, I think I mentioned this the other day, we can only come to the level of Brahman realization, or realizing that the body and the soul are different. One can, if one is very, very good, if one is very intelligent, you know, and maybe meditates for years, you can come to that understanding that the soul is different from the body. But that's as far as you can go. You cannot understand Paramatma, you cannot understand Bhagavan without bhakti, you know, without taking help from. In fact, this was one of the questions. This was the main question that was asked in the chapter 87 of Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, the famous prayers by personified Vedas. Right? That's one you all like to read and study at night when you need to get this. No. You know, it's an interesting thing, because I used to read that every few years I would read that chapter. I thought it was just good for me, even though I didn't understand it. I'll tell you this, for those of you who are a little bit younger, after 50 years, you start to get it. The last time I read it, I kind of understood it. Now, I don't know. So, I mean, it does come together. But the main question asked was, by Maharaj Parikit, was, how do we understand the Absolute? How do we understand transcendence with these material mind and intelligence? Because we're in these material bodies, that's what we have. How can we understand? And we know that we can, in other words, first, you know, we're saying you can't. There's no way that you can understand Krishna, spiritual energy, by the material mind, senses, intelligence, ego, obviously. So how can this be done? And there's, of course, a long discussion by the personified Vedas, the Upanishads. And many, many, they quote, of course, many nice verses, and the Upanishads are there. And basically the conclusion is, you cannot without the help of Krishna. As Jiva Goswami puts it, he says, the mind and intelligence of the Jiva must take help from the Chit-Shakti of the Lord. It is only, in other words, Krishna gives through his own energy, his knowledge, his chit-shakti, he imparts it to the jiva. If the jiva is very sincere and wants to understand him, then he, and of course Krishna says the Bhagavad Gita, doesn't it? You know, to those who are always devoted, I give them the intelligence by which they can come to me. Krishna gives us the intelligence. We don't have it. Now, the material intelligence will not allow us to come to Krishna fully and understand him. But he will give it to us. Right? He's the source of all knowledge, remembrance, and forgetfulness. So that is there, and that's imparted to the jiva. And, of course, part of the more full answer they gave was the whole idea that Prabhupada would often talk about the spiritualization of the senses, right? We have material mind, body, and senses, but we also know the spiritual body is there. And the spiritual body that we all have, that is us, our original body, has spiritual intelligence, spiritual mind, right? I mean, it's not like when you read the stories of our great residents of Vrindavan, people like that, they're obviously using their minds and intelligence, they're speaking to one another, they have cognition, they're making sense, right? I mean, it's not like everyone just floating around in some, permanent state of ecstasy, and there's, you know, no, obviously all these things are there. The difference is, by being spiritual, they're directed towards Krishna. Krishna is the center, and Krishna is the utilization. Otherwise, you know, even like the gopis are always saying, what good are my eyes if they blink and I can't see Krishna? So in other words, everything, as long as it's connected with Krishna, has use to the devotee. And of course, it's not just that it has use, it's who we are. It's our eternal nature. There's no other way it can be. I think my point was, these things tend to be inconceivable, achinta. But through Krishna's grace, we were able to have a little understanding. Even in our neophyte sense, I mean, just like I was saying, when I first read Bhagavad Gita, I said it all made sense. Now, totally about as neophyte as you can be, right? New to Krishna consciousness, how does it make sense to me? What do I know? How could I understand this? I mean, what purification did I have, filled with the anartas, bad habits, everything else? But by Krishna's grace, we're able to understand. We're able to get a glimpse of absolute truth, of reality. And of course, we have to say that not just by Krishna's grace, but obviously Srila Prabhupada's, by the mercy of Guru. That's the mercy manifestation of the Lord. Comes through his devotees. He likes to have his devotees get the credit. He likes his devotees to help to bring the other conditioned souls back to him. Krishna wants us all to be part of him again. We all are part of him, but he wants us to know that we're part of him and to actively be engaged in that realization and understanding. So, he's one with and different from. So, not only is he one with and different, I think it's where I was going with this, with the material energy, with property, but also one with and different from the jiva, the living entity. And sometimes I think we tend to overlook that part of it, because the theory of transformation, Chintabheda Advaita Tattva, is the material energy is both real and not real, but also it's unreal in terms of it's temporary, it's formed of illusion. But for the jiva, I'll get there. It's described that there's actually two types of maya. This is again Jiva Goswami Bhagavat Sandarbha. It says there's jiva maya and guna maya. Now, guna maya is what we're all familiar with, produces prakriti, transforms the bodies of the different entities, the three modes of nature are interacting, and all of this comes into being. It's called guna maya. Jiva maya, he says, is the material energy that covers the living entity. That's another type of maya. The state of illusion, false ego, that we see ourselves as separate from Krishna. Okay? And so we focus a lot on the differences between the living entity and Krishna, and we often need to, because we're in the land of Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, right? Impersonalism, voidism, Mayavadi philosophy, which all stresses oneness with God, right? So we often have to refute that, and our acharyas have to refute that, and Srila Prabhupada certainly did. And so, therefore, we tend to stress away from this idea. No, you're not one with God. You're not equal to God. You have not become God. Now that you become self-realized, now you're God. No, because we know, and we are very small. Krishna is very great, but our philosophy puts equal emphasis on the non-difference of the jiva. So, of course, there's the difference of Krishna jiva, but there's also the non-difference. Now, the jiva's power is very small compared to Krishna. He is the original source of the jiva, but the jiva is qualitatively the same. We have that same nature, Satchitananda. Earlier, the verse of Srimad Bhagavatam is stating that both the jiva and Krishna and the Supreme both have the energies of Samvit, Sandini, and Ladini. They're all there operating for both the living entity and for Krishna. So there is a qualitative sameness, and many examples are given. Srila Prabhupada gives the example of the sun and its rays here in today's purport. Another one that Prabhupada and the Vedic literatures often give is sparks and the fire. You have a fire, and it's the source of everything, of all the heat, light, everything, with different energies. And little sparks may come out of that, which are compared to the living entities. Now, what happens when the sparks are within the fire? They're doing fine, and they're burning brightly. The spark goes off and drops on the ground. What happens to that ember? It starts to go out a little bit. Not that we really go out, but our spiritual nature becomes covered in the same way. And when the spark is back within the fire, then it's okay. Another common example is given is the ocean and a drop of water. Okay? Now, if we analyze the water, I take a drop of water out, it has the same chemical composition as the rest of the ocean, right? It seems just like it in so many ways, but it's very small, it's a single drop compared to the ocean, so there's a definite difference. And also, the ocean is the source of the drop, right? The drop came from the ocean. The ocean didn't come from the drop. The drop of water does not create the ocean. It's the other way around. The other thing is the drop of water cannot exist independently of the ocean. It'll soon dry up too. You take one drop of water out and it evaporates pretty quickly. Now, when the water is back in the ocean, it's rightly situated. It's existing just fine. It's happy. If a drop of water can be happy. But obviously the living entities, given the analogy, we are happy. And it's of the same quality. But when you think about it, all right, the drop of water totally merges into the ocean. But it does it totally merge and give up its identity? Not really. It's saying, at least if you look at a molecule, H2O molecule, it's there, right? It's made up of all these independent molecules that remain. They keep that integrity. So in the same way, the jiva, even when we are back with Krishna, in so many ways the differences are broken down in that all that remains is pure spiritual energy still. The living entity, the jiva, remains separate. So, but how are we the same? Many ways. We're the same in quality. We're the same in interest. When one is purified, one aligns one's desires completely with the desires of Krishna and Guru. In so many ways, the oneness is there. You know, and that's very wonderful. That's when the living entity experiences true life, true spiritual life, true happiness, true satisfaction. And if we're not rightly situated in that original position, we never can be happy. You know, it's like the drop of water out on its own. So one of the lessons of Chaturshloki, and this isn't a plot spoiler for those of you who have that class, because this one's pretty obvious, is that to see anything in this material world is as different from Krishna's illusion. That's probably every Tevatangita verse, right? Anything that we see in this material world, if it's different from Krishna, if it's separate from Krishna, that's illusion. And why is that illusion? Because nothing is different from Krishna. Krishna is everything. There's nothing that is not. How could you even, if you even thought of something, well, maybe this isn't Krishna, then what is it? Where did it come from? You know, it would almost have to be something superior to Krishna if it's not connected with Krishna. And we know that's not possible. Because Krishna is the Supreme Absolute Truth, Adi Purusha, the Supreme Original Person. So, also, if we think that we are apart from Him, or that our interest or even our existence is apart from or different than Krishna, that is also Maya. Yes, we may be eternally different. Krishna says, never was there time when I did not exist, nor you, nor all these kings, nor in the future shall any of us be. In other words, the eternal identity of the spirit soul is absolutely established by Krishna. But at the same time, if we think of ourselves and our interests and our very existence as different, that's Maya. Because where did we come from? We didn't just sort of spontaneously, you know, arise like the Big Bang or something. No. We came from Krishna. We don't know where in time, space. Eternity gets really tough to think about, doesn't it? When did it happen? Was there a time when Krishna thought about expanding himself as living entities? Did it happen at a certain time? The spiritual world is beyond time and space. I mean, it's eternal. So all we can say is generally that we are eternally existing along with Krishna. Krishna manifests his energies. When? You almost can't answer. It's almost not a question you can answer when you talk about, or even ask, when you talk about eternity. So this material world is often referred to as illusion. That's Mayavadi philosophy. But an illusion is something that appears differently from reality. Just like magicians often create different acts, and they're referred to as illusions. Why are they called illusions? Because everyone knows that what the magician is doing isn't what's really happening, right? He's not really cutting the lady in half. You know, he's not really that rabbits are magically manifesting out of his hat by some mystic power. No. Magicians, what they do is they produce creating illusions. That's like misdirection, right? They get you looking over here, in the meantime, they're pulling something out down here. But the props are real, right? They're all there. The rabbit's already there. Everything's there. What you are seeing is something that does exist. It is the interpretation of the activity that is illusion. So that's what the magician does. He creates an illusion by you having a different interpretation, which he wants you to think. He wants you to think that rabbit magically appeared out of the hat, right? So we don't know how it really works. We don't know how it happened. But the magician does, and the magician's in control of it the whole time. So in the same way, Krishna's knowing everything. He is in charge of everything in existence. He's controlling it all, And he knows what's happening. And we may be misdirected over here by Maya, and so we're an illusion and not seeing the real thing. But the devotee understands their relationship, their constitutional position with Krishna. And we need to know that the best result, the way that we're going to understand that constitutional position, the way that we're going to become one with Krishna in that sense of becoming with him, part of his entourage, part of his associates in the spiritual world, or, you know, part of his enacting his desire, enacting that, you know, that our motivation becomes his motivation. We have to know that our real self-interest comes through devotional service to the Lord. Okay? So we need to know Natevidu Svartikatemi Vishnu. The goal of life or the real self-interest is service to Vishnu or Krishna. So in the natural state, we don't have material senses. We're all simply, our spiritual senses do not have independent motive outside of Krishna. And they're all working to engage in Krishna's service. So devotional service is the real self-interest of the Atma. And on a, I'm running out of time, on a deeper level, we learn that the Supersoul Krishna is actually more dear to the soul than even ourselves. Now this one takes some thinking about. Krishna in the wives, story of the wives of the Brahmins, Bhagavatam 10:23-26 says, certainly, expert personalities who can see their own true interests render unmotivated and uninterrupted devotional service directly unto me, for I am most dear to the soul. Krishna is most dear to the soul, to our very selves. Now, this is also described in Lord Brahma's prayers in the 14th chapter of the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, verses starts 54-55. Maharaj Parikit's question after hearing the Brahma Mohana Leela is, he says, oh, how could the coward women have developed for Krishna, someone else's son, such unprecedented pure love they never felt for their own children? Please explain this. Remember, when Krishna expanded as the calves and the boys, the cows and the mothers, the older gopis, felt more love than ever for their own children who were actually now Krishna. So Shukadeva Goswami said, a few verses, says, O King, for every created being, the dearmost thing is certainly one's own self. The dearness of everything else, children, wealth, and so on, is due only to the dearness of the self. If a person comes to the stage of considering the body mine instead of me, he will certainly not consider the body as dear as his own self. After all, even the body is growing old and useless. One's desires continue living remain strong. Therefore, it is his own self that is most dear to every embodied living entity, and simply for the satisfaction of the self, the whole material creation is moving, and non-moving entities exist. He says, you should know Krishna to be the original soul of all living entities. For the benefit of the whole universe, he has out of his causeless mercy appeared as an ordinary human being. He's done this by the strength of his internal potency. The conclusion is that because Krishna is the highest object of love, the greatest love is felt for him. Thus, the Vrajagopis love Krishna even more than they love their own sons. So the idea is, how would we love Krishna even more than our own selves? Because when one has realized, one understands that oneself has no real meaning or reality outside of Krishna, right? In other words, if Krishna were not there, we would not be here. There would be no meaning, no reality, no existence of the self outside of the existence of Krishna. So therefore, the worship of Krishna, the love for Krishna, the care for Krishna, exceeds even the love for one's own self. Now, of course, that's how, and it's described here, that's how the whole material world is working. Because everyone ultimately has care for themselves. In fact, one of the verses, it says the living entity is basically self-centered, centered on the self. And therefore, even though there's some, you know, some attachment to other things, children, family, whatever it might be, ultimately it's to the self, right? And when one understands the nature of the self and who Krishna is, that Krishna is the supreme self, and that the self becomes totally happy in service to that Supreme Self, who was the very cause of our creation, of our existence, then that's perfection. Right. Okay, I should probably stop here. All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Thank you. Well, have I confused everyone? No. Any sukkata? Do we have a sukkata here?
Okay. This might be a weird question, but... So there's the three energies, right? The internal, the external, and the marginal.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems that those that are in, that are kind of be created into the internal, like Mother Yasoda, right, Nanda Maharaj, right?
That they're part of the internal energy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
That's
like,
my understanding.
Like they'll never fall down.
No,
right?
they're Nitya Siddha. Yeah. Well, in fact,
yeah.
They're even more than that.
So it seems like a very fortunate position, as opposed to you're in the marginal, you know, you're in the marginal energy where you make choices and, you know, you kind of work your way. You know what I'm saying? It's like...
Well, kind of,
so,
yeah.
Sometimes I've thought, like, wow, it'd be so great to be part of the internal energy, like never have had to come to the external energy at all, but that some living entities...
Never did.
Is that correct? We're just
three-quarters of the living entities stayed in the spiritual world.
So yeah. That was because of their choice that they could stay there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and of course then Prabhupada said, I remember one letter Prabhupada said, when one reaches the spiritual world who's from a sadhana siddha, as I'm assuming most of us are, unless some of you are pure souls who came down for your mission on earth. But most of us are sadhana siddhas, we can assume. Prabhupada says, sadhana siddha, nitya siddha, no difference. Once you're there, it's the same. Once you come back, you're completely welcome. Everyone, you know, Krishna welcomes you, everyone welcomes you. You know, we're just good to see you again. It's kind of like if your child was away for many years, you wouldn't start out saying, and the first thing you would say was, where have you been? You'd say, oh, I'm so glad. Well, you might. But, you know, anyway, we're just really happy they're back, you know. But the question, I don't know if you're asking, are some of those personalities who are eternal associates more so, like are they in a different category of Shakti Tattva or Vishnu Tattva?
I guess. I mean, it doesn't seem like everything's equal.
Not exactly. Yeah, Mother Yashoda and Mount Nandaraj are eternally.
Right.
The parents of Krishna, they're obviously very, very special devotees.
Is that due to their own desire, or is that due to just the way they were created? I guess that was part of the question.
Well, it's both. Like, I mean, it's their desire, but it's also, you know, it's who we are.
Yeah.
You know, it's like that question always comes up, like, what if I don't like who I am in the spiritual world? Well, you're going to, because it's who you are. Everyone is going to be perfectly situated according to your desire. You know, and if it wasn't your desire, Krishna wants to fulfill our desires. He wants us to serve him in however we want to serve him, in different rasas, in different ways, perhaps even in different incarnations. Maybe you want to be a devotee of Ramachandra. Well, there's a planet you can go to of Ram's planet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, generally most of us in this sampradaya, we tend to be focused on Krishna and Krishna's pastimes and, you know, those essential rasas revolving around Krishna. Yeah, now I've never been quite clear on that because sometimes in some of the Goswami's writings and like that, they refer to some of these great personalities almost like they are in a different category.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, for instance, I think Rupa Goswami says like the eight principal gopis are all expansions of Radharani.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think they're not jivas. You know, they're, from what I understand, from Rupa Goswami's saying, they're, you know, they're in a different category. They're expansions of Radharani, you know. But, you know.
In one sense, we're all expansions, right? In one sense?
What's that?
In one sense, we're all expansions?
Well, you can kind of go there, too. Then what's the difference? You know, I mean, everyone's an expansion. Everyone is an expansion of Krishna. So it's kind of like, you know, and everyone is personality. Everyone has, you know, there's relationship, you know. So, I mean, I don't think... I mean, of course, Radharani has her best friends, perhaps, Lalitam Shak and those, but it's not that you know, another gopi comes by and says, oh, you're just a jiva. No. Every, you know, it's a wonderful, as they say, big happy family there in Vrindavan. And anything that isn't happy is really just for the purposes of pastimes, you know, to enhance the interest of the pastimes.
I just one other quick question. Just like you say, everything's part of Krishna, so sometimes you think all the most horrible things that happen in this world, you know? It doesn't seem like, how can that be part of Krishna?
Because one of Krishna's great attributes is free will. And as we are small part and parcels, he gave us that little bit of free will, and we really misuse it badly. We create so much karma through the misuse of that free will. Krishna does not want to see the living entities suffer, but he allows it. He allows the natural consequences of material energy to unfold. And hopefully that's going to eventually teach us that this is not a very good place to be. We want to get out of here. We want to go back home, back to God. Other questions? Guru Prashad?
Thank you, Prabhu, for a wonderful class. Hopefully these things will become clearer as we become more purified. But you're saying that the gopis were able to love Krishna more than their son, and ultimately we, because Krishna is in our heart, is that what, did I miss the point?
Well, of course, Krishna is in our heart, but in other words, Krishna is most dear to every living entity because, you know, because it is. Krishna is like the soul of every living entity, the soul of our souls. In other words, Krishna is there originally. We came from Krishna. So we cannot really enjoy or be attached to or love anything outside without Krishna. And, you know, Krishna being the dearmost beloved object of every living entity, they were experiencing and had Krishna directly. I mean, I know this is tough for you mothers, but think about it for a moment. You have your, and you know how much you love your children. But think if you had baby Krishna there, you know, you might actually be a little more attached even than your own children. You know, well, it's so wonderful.
Well, the closest I can come to understanding that is sometime when I have to do like dress deities. I had some big problem with my fingers, you know, pain. Mm. And I thought, oh my God, how am I going to do this today? And so once I started dressing, I completely forgot because that was more important than the pain. And I thought, well, I have to get the service done today. And I started dressing, I didn't think of it until I talked about it a few minutes ago. But that's the only thing I could think. Why was I able to put that about myself? Like, you know, this is my body, I'm suffering, I have this pain.
And you had that strong desire to serve Krishna, so Krishna gave you help, right? Mm-hmm.
So I was thinking, is that because I was thinking, did I love Krishna more than myself? I was trying to understand the point you were making.
Okay.
So
we all do ultimately, just to the degree that we understand. I would put it this way. Sometimes we have that realization and sometimes we do not, I would say. As we're in the state of purification, of becoming purified, you know, of self-realization, you know, there will be a point when that will be our realization all the time. And now we probably don't always have it, honestly speaking, but there are certain things that tend to bring out and where Krishna seems to empower even us neophyte devotees. I think deity worship is one of those. I think preaching on his behalf is one of those. I mean, every book distributor will tell you stories where they knew they couldn't have done what happened, you know, without Krishna Lord Chaitanya directly empowering them. Or there's so many stories from pujaris about experiences they had or things they overcame or things that, like you said, you know, that Krishna just gave you the ability to do it. Yeah. Okay. Well, he was in front of him first.
Thank you for the nice class. Somebody asked me this a few weeks ago, and it's actually, I've been contemplating it too, and so many of Prabhupada's purports, he talks about, you know, how Krishna is not impersonal in Nirvishesha Sunyavadi, how we have to overcome this impersonal conception that Krishna is a person. And it's, you know, just reading purport after purport, Prabhupada brings it up again and again and again. And the person asked, like, well, in the Western world, most people know that God is a person, so why is Prabhupada keep repeating this over? And I also started thinking, you know, also it would be, sometimes I think if I heard more principles about practical application of Krishna consciousness, how I can over that, but of course I, you know.
Well, the acharya is right according to time and circumstance, and those things which are important, excuse me. I just read, excuse me, Chaitanya Bhagavat and Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Maharaj's purports. As any of you have read it, know that he is incessantly hammering on Prakriti Sahajas, right? Anybody remember how he goes at them, especially in the first part of the book, purport after purport, and after a while you're kind of thinking, why? Because that was the issue then. That was what he was confronting, that's what he was dealing with. You know, this total bogus, you know, interpretation, misinterpretation of Vaishnavism. So now, so Prabhupada, he comes to the West and he says it's the land of Nirvishesha Shunyavadi, impersonalism and voidism. Well, I'd say the voidism is definitely there within materialism. Basically, that there is really, you know, really nothing in existence outside of once material energy is gone, that's it. You know, once you die, you die, you know, that sort of thing. I think that there a lot of people's actual conception, when you come down to it, there's a lot of impersonalism in it, even within other religions. Now, I would say at its core basis, religions like Christianity are personal. I mean, they don't have a good conception, right? And not a very detailed idea of who God is as a person, but I think that if you ask them, many of them would say, yeah, he's a person. So now, of course, in India, it's a whole other story. He was probably in India constantly dealing with impersonalists. I mean, this is something that is so pervading. I told this before, I think, once, but I used to go to, a few years ago, I used to go up regularly to a program in Jacksonville, and it was a nice congregation. Well, it was about 99% Indians, Indian people of Indian origin, devotees. And, you know, they were coming for a while, and some were really nice. This one woman would come every time, and I thought she was really nice, you know, and she seemed real eager about everything, kirtan and everything. And so it was question and answer time after I gave class. And, you know, finally she says, oh, and then finally we'll all become God, right? I thought, it was so deeply rooted that, and I don't think she was committed to that particularly, but that's all she was heard. That's what she was taught. That's what she thought, oh, what I really should be understanding sometime, I'll understand that, you know, I mean, all this worship of Krishna is really nice, but ultimately I'll understand that it's, you know, it's all one and, you know, one. So it's very deeply there in many parts of the world, many places. I think we find examples where there's a lot of impersonalism built within all of us, you know, where we do tend to sort of, God becomes an abstraction. And I think when it becomes theoretical or an abstraction, that's a form of impersonalism. You know, rather than really sort of seeing that Krishna is here with me, protecting me, guiding me, I should be involved in loving relationships all the time with him. And I think in some ways that our conception of impersonalism maybe prevent us from our full surrender to Krishna and, you know, fully understanding him.
Seems like also not wanting to deal with even people, you know, the impersonal aspect. I don't want to deal with this person.
There's that.
And everyone is a part of Krishna. If we love Krishna, we love everyone. That concept too is And you're mentioning the Christians. I've heard before that, you know, their personal conception. It's almost as if, you know, they're trying to go to heaven. It's like they're as if they're worshiping Brahma.
Or at least, yeah, their idea is to go to the heavenly planets.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the West, maybe they claim, you know, God is the Father, but it's pretty vague. It's not Vaishnava personalism. You know, maybe if you hand it to the Indians, at least they're upfront about being personal. It's not this, you know, worship God, the Father, the material stuff. And it's practically not part of their lives. other than to just provide. But anyways, but we're trying to get to, to kind of, realizations of Gaudiya Vaishnavas. But hey, one thing like Sudhir was like, seemed to be, she was lamenting she wasn't a Nitya Siddha or something.
I'm sorry, say it.
Sukhita seemed to be lamenting she wasn't a Nitya Siddha. Mother Sukhita seemed to be lamenting that she wasn't a Nitya Siddha.
Oh.
But if you go back to Godhead, assuming you go back, and Prabhupada says you never fall down again, and there's no time in the sense we can experience it here in this, material, then suddenly you're a Nitya Siddha because you're there and you're never going to fall down again. And there's no time, it's eternal.
Yeah, that's what Prabhupada said. Nitya Siddha, Sadhana Siddha, same.
Yeah.
And Krishna says, one who goes there will never return.
Yeah, so, Nitya Siddha. But the other thing about considering Nitya Siddha is they want to be there. It's not like they passively, I'm here, I've got nowhere to go.
No, they can come here with us.
Yeah, they could if they wanted. And, if we want to be there, we got to want to be there too. So it's not like they're just passively there. And, I got nowhere to, they want to be there.
Yeah.
So we have to have that desire as well.
Right now, we only want to be there sometimes. When things get really tough, we want to be there. When things are okay, we don't think.
We only want to be there when time heart is fast.
Hare Krishna.
Of course.
Or when we hear Prabhupada's words, that convinces us.
So, Lord Krishna said that I can only be understood by unalloyed devotional service.
Yeah.
But yet we see a lot of people exhibit knowledge about Krishna, even rather deep knowledge, but they seemingly don't have much devotion, or they're not austere or anything, but yet they exhibit a lot of knowledge of Krishna. How can you explain the difference there?
I mean, there's knowledge and there's realized knowledge. And that's very clear in the Bhagavad Gita that there's different levels of knowledge. I mean, in other words, I could repeat the philosophy. I could just find a verse and say, oh, by the way, and I could read the verse, or I might even memorize that verse. So that's knowledge. But when Krishna says only by undivided devotional service can I be known as I am standing before you, what does that mean? That means you actually are knowing Krishna, knowing the sarup, the form of Krishna, knowing him completely, complete realization. And that's where it has to be undivided devotional service, without it has to be a haitukhiya priyata, without motivation, right? Without stopping. Okay, I think we're running late and everyone's leaving. Hare Krishna, Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada.